Revolutions Per Minute is a weekly radio show from the New York City chapter of the Democratic Socialists of America. Recorded live at WBAI 99.5 in Brooklyn every Wednesday at 9 p.m. RPM spent doing the work to build a democratic socialist future. Each week, hear the latest news, analysis, and organizing experience from the minds and hearts of activists fighting every day in New York City. Join the movement at socialists.nyc.
Yo, what's good, New York? This is Jack Devine, he, him pronouns, and you are listening to Revolutions Per Minute live from the new WBI studios. We're a socialist radio show and podcast for members of the New York City Democratic Socialists of America. The DSA is the largest socialist organization in the United States, with 95,000 members nationwide, and NYC DSA is its biggest chapter. We are run by our 7,000-plus members and organizers who are working together to build democratic socialism in all five boroughs. The world is on fire, and the organizations of the international working class are the only force capable of putting it out. Union organizer and campaign worker Marvin Gonzalez, a member of the National DSA's International Committee, joins us to discuss his recent trip to the Conference of the International in Venezuela. After that, we hear from Zineb Ahmed on Afghanistan. Later in the show, we will speak to Better Tomorrow. We'll also speak to DSA International Committee member Sipera Makarami, as well as Don Rhodes from NYC DSA Anti-War Working Group. The trio will discuss how the socialist movement has been at the forefront of organizing efforts to assist Afghan refugees and how we can all work to challenge the power of American capitalist imperialism in the military-industrial complex. But first, the headlines with Chris.
Bill de Blasio has mandated that all city workers return to the office full-time without a telework option. 65% of city workers have received a COVID-19 vaccine, well below the 78% of NYC adults with at least one shot. The federal government has promised aid to New Yorkers who suffer damages from storms caused by Hurricane Ida. Self-harm has spiked in New York City jails since the beginning of the pandemic. City jails recorded 539 incidents of incarcerated people hurting themselves in April to June of this year, pushing up the rate up to 95 such incidents per every 1,000 detainees, the highest in the last 5 years. Governor Hochul signed into law a bill that the state legislature had passed in April, requiring that all new passenger vehicles sold in the state be zero-emission models by 2035. Nearly a million students returned to New York City's public school buildings on Monday after a year and a half of remote and hybrid learning. Some parents, unsatisfied with the planned COVID precautions, such as testing once every 2 weeks without consequences for opting out, are choosing to homeschool their children. Calls are growing for Lieutenant Governor Brian Benjamin to divest completely from NexPoint, an investor group that recently acquired LoanMe, a high-interest lending company that charges up to 500% interest on small personal loans. Lieutenant Governor Benjamin stated that LoanMe does not do business in New York State, which considers interest rates above 25% to be criminal. In election news, DSA-endorsed Buffalo mayoral candidate India B. Walton and incumbent Byron Brown sparred in their first head-to-head debate months after Brown lost to Walton in the Democratic primary. Brown is still currently slated to appear on the general election ballot, despite missing the petition filing deadline to run on an independent line. After a rare round of statewide public hearings, the state Senate Elections Committee will be holding its regular post-election oversight hearing to review the messy primaries earlier this year. So those are the headlines brought to you by The Thorn. This is Chris, now back to the studio for tonight's show.
And as Chris just said, our headlines are brought to you by The Thorn, an incredible weekly newsletter by NYC DSA Electoral Working Group covering local politics and radical activism. Subscribe at thethorn.nyc. So we're now joined by Marvin Gonzalez, a member of DSA's international committee and is just an organizer and a worker, union organizer and campaign worker. Thanks so much for joining us, Marvin.
Hey, can you hear me?
Yeah, we can hear you, Marvin.
Great. Happy to be here. I'm happy to be here for the second time.
Yeah, we're happy to have you back on Revolutions Per Minute. Marvin is a big supporter of the show and the station, so we're very happy to have Marvin back on the air. So I just, Marvin, you were down in Venezuela a couple months ago. I believe it was the end of June. You know, a lot of things were happening across South and Central America, as well as the Caribbean. There was a revolutionary upsurge in Haiti, a critical election happening in Peru, where the socialist candidate ended up being successful. Things are heating up around the world. So I'm just curious, Marvin, what's your general assessment of what's going on? What were the strategic priorities of the socialist and communist parties of the world in the international? What was their focus? What was their assessment of the power of the organized forces of the working workers of the world? And who are our most dangerous enemies?
Yeah, it was an interesting time to go. It was before, you know, Pedro Castillo had secured his victory in Peru. But it was after kind of the Bolivian coup had been overturned. So we went there as guests of the Simón Bolívar Institute, which is a institute of the government that tries to promote socialism abroad, and solidarity with the Venezuelan socialist movement. So when we were there, it was interesting because, I think that, everyone was kind of hopeful. There was a sense of kind of overturning some of the reactionary, events that had happened on the continent in the last, you know, few months. There's reason to be nervous, like I said, because Castillo had yet to really, you know, his opponent had not conceded yet. But it was a very hopeful moment, and one thing that we really heard the whole time was a focus on American imperialism specifically. There was a very unified sense that everyone knew that kind of the main enemy was the U.S. government.
Yeah, I mean, especially when you're down in South America, it's hard to, you know, escape the reality that the U.S. government, the CIA in particular, but more broadly, just the forces of American imperialism have consistently crushed the left alongside the forces of reaction within those countries themselves. And I think I'm just curious, you know, looking at what you think going forward is going to be the main focus. I mean, there was these kind of very fraudulent small level protests in Cuba that the American capitalist media love to focus on that were just ridiculous in comparison to this sort of repression faced by the working class and basically any country where capital reigns in Central and South America. So I'm just curious what you see going forward, maybe with the kind of the situation heating up in places like Brazil, maybe more broadly international, DSA's International Committee. What is kind of the main focus of internationalist politics from someone coming from New York moving forward?
So in 2019, I believe the DSA passed a resolution at our convention that made working in like the Americas and Latin America specifically our priority of internationalist work, and that's still kind of the framework that we've been operating under. Like you brought up a lot of, you know, things that are definitely on the radar. We want to keep close tabs on what's going to happen in Brazil. There's going to be one of you know, probably the most important elections of our lifetime. I know that people say that all the time, but I think that, like, that's actually, you know, with climate the way it is, I think it's going to really affect everyone around the world. And definitely what's happening in Chile, So we definitely have a bunch of things that we are keeping an eye on that we want to, you know, participate as observers. I think that like you called attention to kind of the situation in Cuba, anti-sanctions work is definitely something that we've been working on, and something that our America subcommittee just made a priority campaign. So you're going to see a lot more, work on anti-sanctions work, from the DSA going forward.
Yeah, I think the Cuban Solidarity Campaign seems to be absolutely a crucial focus going on, especially with the kind of the reversal in the direction from the federal government here, and kind of pushing that forward and standing in solidarity with Workers' Party in Brazil will be a key focus in Latin America. Is there, Marvin, is there anything you want to add that you think our listeners here on WBAI and members in NYC DSA and DSA members across the country should view as crucially important to the next few months or year or so? Anything that they should be giving their attention to or focus on campaigns that they should be paying attention to?
I think that focusing on sanctions is going to be critically important. And that's going to be relying on putting pressure on the existing government. You know, Biden has yet to like undo some of the really brutal and really criminal sanctions that were put in place by Trump. And their justification for that is often that they don't want to alienate centrist voters in Florida and in other key swing states. So I think putting pressure on our government to let them know that, you know, that kind of rationale is just not going to fly is kind of going to be very critical in the next year. And I would also say that, you know, the DSAIC, the DSA International Committee, has regular rounds of membership where people can join. I think the last one was yesterday, but, you know, in a few more months, you can apply again. So I think that people should really try to prioritize actual organizing in DSA and not just kind of pressure campaigns.
That makes a lot of sense to me. And I just want to thank you so much for joining us, Marvin. And we are going to keep our eyes on everything that's going on around the world. There's clearly a lot of political activity happening in Latin America, which has been your focus on the IC. And I think, in general, the struggle for socialism around the world and its fascist and imperialist enemies are increasingly at each other's throats. So just thank you so much for joining us, Marvin. And we're going to be shifting to the focus of our rest of the show, which is going to remain internationalist. But we are going to turn to an interview that we have on Afghanistan with Zainab Ahmed. So let's roll that clip right now.
That was the sound of protesters in New York demanding that the Biden administration allow more Afghan refugees into America. To understand more about Afghanistan's history and politics, I spoke to Zainab Ahmed, a writer, activist, academic, and organizer based in Brooklyn. I started by asking Zainab what she thought about the old cliche that Afghanistan was the graveyard of empires.
The reason it's not helpful is because it's not true, right? Afghanistan was the center of a large empire, like during the Durrani period, right? Shortly before the Mughals and the British. But also it puts the historical narrative way, way back in a way that doesn't work. It just gives you the complete wrong idea of history, right? The fact of the matter is that the current period of instability and imperial competition is linked to the capitalist period, and like the modernization that has taken place alongside the growth of capitalism.
During the 19th century, Afghanistan was the scene of the Great Game, a diplomatic confrontation between the Russian Empire of the Tsars and the British Empire of Queen Victoria.
Like my own feminist perspective would pay heed to like patriarchy as a social force that exists like in Marxist terms within and outside of the mode of production, right? Like Afghanistan and Northwest Pakistan are unique in that like the way that capitalism developed there was not like market first, right? And like capitalism's impact was mostly at first, and this continues to large extent, like in the military and the bureaucracy, right? So you have like a very well-developed military and bureaucracy element, right? Like these political aspects of the state, but the economic aspects have like continued to be underdeveloped, like. And that's like led to this really interesting composite situation, basically, right? Where like a traditional Marxist feminist like idea of what's going on, right? Which is that capitalism develops in such a way where gender and social reproduction are needed in order to like accompany the growth of like wage labor. That's not what's going on, right? Like it's not what's going on, like. Wage labor is not like the main factor here when understanding patriarchy. The military is, and like bureaucratic management needs are, right? And then everything falls into place around that. That's why you have these like powerful men that are representatives of communities. That's why the Taliban is created to like give Pakistan like a little bit of like strategic depth, but also like existential security that like the country's in control based like largely around gender, like everything kind of falls from that.
I then asked Zainab about the weakness of the US-backed regime in Afghanistan and the argument of Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Steve Cole that the Taliban are simply a proxy force for Pakistan's intelligence services.
People make alliances with like other powers and like in order to like firm up their social base and their position, right, and to make inroads against other people who are, like, presumed to have their own foreign, like, alliances, right? I mean, it's like civil wars and proxies are often like this. And you know, I mean, it's like, and, like, all of those things are true at once, you know what I mean? Like, you have these foreign powers that are interfering, and also, like, a foreign power would not be able to just cause a movement to happen like simply by throwing money at it, right? This is what I think a lot of people on the left think this, but it's not really true, right? Like it doesn't really make any sense. Like you have to interact with like a class of people, or you have to interact with like, oh, this grouping, like this seems secure and stuff like that, and those decisions are the result of like real evaluation that is made. And often those partners are men. There are relatively novel issues that come up after 2001 that, like, account for, like, why exactly the government was so unstable, right? Like, it did not have an organic footing in Afghan society, right? This is part of the thing about proxies, right? I mean, it's like people say that the Taliban is a proxy, right? Like, if it was really what people say it is, right? Like this like Pakistani like thing that is thrown at Afghanistan to run it without like any real support on the ground, then like it would not be as successful as it is, because the Afghan government like shows you what like a proxy that's held up by foreign financing actually looks like, right? It just lacked the like ideological command to, like on the ground, and like it was made up largely of like ambitious warlords and bureaucrats and stuff like that that were like sort of like had their own little like niches of influence, right? But like we're never really brought together into like a cohesive whole, right? And there are a lot of reasons for that, including the fact that, like, the government as a whole lacked democratic legitimacy. Like, I don't think the fact that there were elections doesn't change that, right? Like, it lacked democratic legitimacy. Like, it was, like, seen as corrupt by a lot of people. Whether or not it is, like, another question, but it was seen as corrupt. It had very, very little, like, strength or influence over, like, basic living need requirements.
So do you think, in a way, America got the colonialism wrong by basically just relying far too narrowly on this, like, this small elite without really, like, that America's problem was that they, like, they were like, we're going to occupy Afghanistan, but they didn't really put down any particular infrastructural roots in the country to actually be able to do that beyond the kind of military-industrial complex.
Well, I mean, there were a couple of problems, right? Like, in one way, like, empire was done right, in that, like, the Talibani government was overthrown through a mixture of, like, international, like, military offensives, and also working with long-standing partners locally that would form the nucleus of a new government, right? That's very classically an imperial approach. It's what the British would have done, right? Like, there are a couple of other problems here. Like, mainly it's neoliberalism, honestly. Like you saw a variation of this in Iraq, right? Like neoliberalism is why these military initiatives just happen really, really quickly and based on, like, the moral and emotional state of some institution or, like, some view of the electorate or whatever, or some section of the ruling class, and then the war happens really fast, right? Before proper plans and, like, can be made as to, like, what is the military's combat role, like, what is the development role, like, what are the stated objectives, like, how are you going to get there and stuff like that. So, you know, I mean, it's like, that's like one major thing, right? Is that, like, neoliberalism created the situation where, military initiatives happen very, very quickly and without, like, plans for, like, the impact beyond, like, an immediate combat victory. It's also happened in Libya, right? Right? Like, it's just not really how, a lot of people in those institutions are thinking at the moment when they go to war, right? Like, it just happens really fast. It's justified in a humanitarian way, and then everybody goes home, right? It's not really how this stuff worked in the European imperial period, right? In the European imperial period, you would have, like, really destructive wars, right? But the powers that be were also thinking about, like, the wider ramifications of each individual war, right? What would go into securing a territory and stuff like that, right? I just don't think neoliberal economics prepares people to do that.
You're listening to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your favorite podcast app. Today, we're talking about internationalism and imperialism. We just heard an interview with Zainab Ahmed on Afghanistan. We were talking with Marvin Gonzalez from the DSA International Committee, and we'll be joined by another member of the International Committee coming right up. But before we do that, I just want to remind everyone that this is a listener-funded station. And WBAI is a community radio station that is democratically run. If you donate $25 within a year, you become a democratic voter within the station with ability to elect people to local station board. It's also alongside the staff representative, of which I am one. So this is a station that is controlled democratically by the listener members alongside the staff. And this kind of creates a different sort of media operation. We're not operating the same sense that capitalist media is. We're driven by entirely by the profit motive and run by capital. And that changes the dynamics where if you have a capitalist enterprise, you have private ownership that is often trying to push a line that is holding on to the power of capital and its role within society. This is a democratic and socialist really run operation run by the workers and by the listeners. And so we need your support. And you can do that in a variety of ways. You can go to the website, WBAI.org, and just donate on there. Go just straight to the webpage and you'll see it right on the front. Or you can go to become a BAI buddy. And there's another way you can do that also on the website. This is kind of the big way to go about it. Or you can call 212-209-2950. Again, that's 212-209-2950. So give to the station, become a member. You can vote in the elections, become an active member of the station. We need media like this that is worker run, and we can kind of connect it to the broader working movement. Having a show like this that is connected to NYC DSA, it's the official radio show. And so we're connected to working class organization, socialist organization that is pushing for a politics of the people and for democracy rather than the people who are running this country and are kind of running the world into the ground and violently attacking all these places that we are talking about tonight. So just go to WBA.org and donate. So we're now going to kind of transition to our next segment. We are still going to be focused on Afghanistan. We have a few guests with us. We mentioned before, but we're going to first be directing this question at Hemala. Hemala, can you tell us a little bit about Afghans for a Better Tomorrow, the organization you co-founded, and the work you've been doing with the Afghan diaspora in New York?
Yeah, sure thing, Jack. It's Halima. So Afghans for a Better Tomorrow is a group of dedicated progressive organizers in the Afghan diaspora. And we were essentially born out of the impending withdrawal that we knew was going to happen. And so really we started to put together action items, demands, I would say probably around April of 2021. Just as the onset of withdrawal announcement happened and so on. And so since then we've been, adjusting our demands as policy, adjusted and changed by the Biden administration. And so we've really been, quite busy, especially in the last couple of weeks as we've seen, Kabul fall to the Taliban and really all of Afghanistan.
So what would you say is like the most crucial thing to get after right now, the focus of your organization, I mean, within this crisis moment? How can people maybe listening to the show help out in this fight? What's kind of the key thing that's going on right now?
Yeah, absolutely. So at this moment in time, it's incredibly crucial for some type of humanitarian corridor to be pushed forward by the United States and other allied countries, just for the simple fact that Afghanistan is a pretty impoverished country to begin with. But with the withdrawal of the United States and other countries, that's essentially created a vacuum and essentially set it up for even more poverty. I'm sure the audience has seen before, banks are running out of cash, resources are very low when it comes to food, medical supplies, things along those lines. And so one of the things that Afghans for a Better Tomorrow is pushing hard for is the establishment of a humanitarian corridor so that organizations, humanitarian organizations, can actually send, various things that are needed by the Afghan people. I think one thing to really highlight and hit home is that, most of the Afghan people do not want the Taliban in power. And so they're sort of in this helpless situation where, they can't leave the country because the borders are all closed. Pakistan, Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Iran have all closed their borders. And so, essentially the landlocked nation, the folks within it have nowhere to go. And so that becomes even more critical for humanitarian assistance and aid to reach the Afghan people.
Yeah, I mean, it's clearly an awful situation that has arisen. And I think we're going to get into later in the show, and I think with Sipera and Don as well, about the kind of the role that the U.S. has had, U.S. empire has had in empowering sort of reactionary forces in the past, like the Taliban, and many of the other reactionary regimes in the region, that has kind of created this void in the first place, and kind of create a situation where it's very, very difficult for a sort of a democratic and worker-led movement to rise up in places like Afghanistan. But before we do that, I just want to direct this to both Don and Sipera, since you guys are both active members in NYC DSA, anti-war, has NYC DSA anti-war working group been involved in helping Afghan refugees escape the horrors that American imperialism has brought in the region?
Yes. Hi. Thanks so much for having us. With regards to the developments in Afghanistan, we didn't directly, organize actions or organize around the issue. We tried our best to, find groups and organizations like organizations that Halima is from and is organizing and supporting them. So the action that we had together in front of Chuck Schumer's apartment in Park Slope was one effort that we helped organize. New York City DSA has had a history of supporting other groups in their actions and their sort of struggle with logistical help. And a lot of times we get involved with other organizations through Red Rabbits, and shout out to Red Rabbits and the comrades there who helped us also in organizing the protest in front of Schumer's apartment to demand the United States take responsibility for the mess that it created, and for the just horrible way it is hurting people's lives in Afghanistan, and do the bare minimum that we're have to do, and let those refugees and those who seek refuge in our country in, otherwise help their lives, revive their lives, help their lives in every way possible, whether they need to stay or they need to move. I think Halima was talking about the organizing better than me, so I would like to pass it back to her or you, Jack.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think it's important that we are kind of, that NYC DSA and other organizations in the fight against imperialism are out there and kind of, pushing for one, solidarity with the Afghani people and refugees that are have faced the brunt in one sense of American imperialist violence, and relatedly, the violence of the Taliban and kind of other reactionary forces with Afghanistan. Additionally, that we are kind of pointing to, individuals in the ruling class like Chuck Schumer and kind of out there protesting and drawing this connection to the empowered forces in this country who have helped facilitate this sort of thing over the long term. But I think there are questions over more broadly about how to build the sort of movement that can actually challenge the power of empire. And I think these are great key first steps, and kind of also developing the sort of international committee that you are on, Sipera, and DSA, I think is a really crucial thing in building the sort of organizational connections that Marvin was talking about earlier that exist between DSA and Latin America. But Halima, what can the people listening to our show do to show solidarity with the people of Afghanistan? And maybe as well, how do your demands to migration.
Jack, you cut off a little bit towards the end. Do you mind repeating your last question?
Yeah, sorry. The second question would just be how do the demands, your demands of your organization, maybe more broadly of also NYC DSA, so I'm also happy for Aspera Danta to answer this question, but how do these demands connect more broadly with the idea of removing barriers to migration for refugees?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think, you know, first things first, no human is illegal. And I think that's something that needs to be especially highlighted, especially in a United States that looks at refugees in a very negative light. And so one of the things that Afghans for a Better Tomorrow pushes for is for the United States to take in Afghan refugees, to lift the cap that is currently in place that very much restricts the amount of Afghans that can come into the United States. And so we're pushing for that to be lifted. I think, and Sepper, you know, briefly touched upon this, I think the United States has a unique responsibility to Afghanistan and to the Afghan people for not only the failure that is the 20 years of recent war, but really the last 45 years of U.S. imperialism and meddling into the affairs of Afghanistan, you know, dating back to the Cold War era with the Soviet Union. And so, you know, that's something that Afghans for a Better Tomorrow really pushes for. We also ask that fee waivers be applied in this instance. I think a lot of times, you know, folks that want to seek refuge in a country like the United States, you know, the financial cost of actually applying for these type of applications, such as humanitarian parole, are a barrier. Right now, it's $575 per humanitarian parole application fee. And so if you multiply that by, let's say, a family of four or six or 10, you know, that becomes an exorbitant amount, an exorbitant cost. And so a lot of times, you know, Afghan families that are inside of Afghanistan can't necessarily support that or be able to drop over $5,000 for their family members. And so, you know, part of what a lot of folks in the Afghan diaspora has been doing is fundraising to be able to cover the costs of those applications. In the meantime, we are still pushing for that fee to be waived. It doesn't make any sense for that humanitarian parole application fee to be still standing right now, just given the complete chaos that the withdrawal has been by the United States. One of our other demands is to end drone strikes in Afghanistan and really broadly everywhere that it's used. As we've seen with the most recent drone strike in Kabul, you know, the United States military intelligence thought that they were hitting some sort of ISIS militant. And instead it was literally a regular, you know, Kabul resident going about his day, doing his job, you know, filling water canisters and things like that. And unfortunately, this is who the United States thought was some sort of military threat. And he was killed. You know, 10 people total were killed, all of them civilians. And so Afghans for a Better Tomorrow and broadly, you know, additional Afghan diaspora groups are vehemently against drone strikes. And that's something that unfortunately, the Biden administration continuously repeats via over-the-horizon policy, and that's essentially drone strikes. As we've seen with the recent Kabul strike, as we've seen throughout the entirety of the war, drone strikes are not effective. You know, more often than not, civilians on the ground, you know, when you check in with them and ask them, you know, what happened, they'll almost always confirm that, you know, who the persons or the people that were killed in these drone strikes were just civilians, regular people going about their day. And so we definitely, you know, call for all ceasing of any type of drone strikes. And then finally, our last demand, and I briefly touched upon this earlier, is humanitarian aid. And so the United States must provide an emergency humanitarian aid package, you know, just because there's almost 500,000 people already displaced in Afghanistan internally. One in three Afghans will be going hungry, and that number is expected to quickly go up. And so it's just, you know, at all levels, a catastrophic withdrawal, a catastrophic end to, you know, 20 years of war. And so those are the main three demands of Afghans for a Better Tomorrow.
A key set of demands, and I mean, the demands kind of really highlight the way that you know, the U.S. has destroyed Afghanistan in so many ways, and then kind of is pulling out. And the military force was not helping things; it was making things worse, but pulling out and leaving people with nothing. So I think it's crucial to, you know, do anything we can in the movement to, you know, stand with the oppressed people of Afghanistan and fight for this sort of aid and end to violence like drone strikes as possible. And I just want to let our listeners know that we have around 15 minutes left in the show, and you're tuning in to Revolutions Per Minute on listener-sponsored WBAI in New York City, broadcasting at 99.5 FM and streaming on your podcast app. We've been talking about the situation in Afghanistan and internationalism, the fight for internationalism on the socialist left. And I just want to let our listeners know that you can call in at 212-209-2877. Again, that number is 212-209-2877. If you're interested in talking about this issue, a number of things related internationally, or you just have something on your mind that's related to, maybe the struggle for socialism around the world, just call in at 212-209-2877. So Don Sapere, I want to direct this towards you. In what ways is the 20-year war in Afghanistan connected to a much longer and widespread history of American imperialism in the region? And how have organizers connected it to our broader efforts to disrupt the merchants of death in the defense industry and the imperialist and their imperialist war on terror?
Thanks, Jack. This is Don. I think, and Halema touched on this very well before, I think we actually need to step back and look at it even broader over the last 45 years of U.S. imperialism. The United States has been destabilizing Afghanistan for much longer. The CIA and the broader U.S. security state were funded and armed some extremely right-wing reactionary groups within Afghanistan that a large part of which formed the basis of the Taliban and the current situation that that we're in now. As that progressed and as what became the Taliban eventually took over, also formed the base of a reactionary base for terrorism in Afghanistan, and in a very classic imperial case of chickens coming home to roost, the very groups that the United States was in the 1980s eventually turned on the US held a base for Al Qaeda to strike the US in 2001, and at that point, and this is a large focus of what our campaign is doing at the moment, we initiated a legal regime that allows the US to strike anywhere, anytime, for basically any reason, and has basically given the president and the military carte blanche to strike wherever they want. It is really a pretty unprecedented situation when you look at all of U.S. imperial history. And I'll hand it over to Sapere a little bit to talk about the...
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's a very, very good question and a very good point that this has not just been going on for 20 years, and it's been over 40 years of U.S. intervention and U.S. destabilizing the region in general, specifically Afghanistan. And as Don so eloquently put it, it was basically a very, very crucial point in history, the 2001 sort of attacks on the Twin Towers, and how the United States sort of used that to destroy any sort of effort that was left in the political atmosphere in the region in general, and to normalize, as they would say, relationships with the West and specifically with the United States. You see, after the 9/11 attacks, they basically, after the Axis of Evil speech, the famous Axis of Evil speech in by Bush, all the efforts that the Iranian government, for example, was making to make some sort of connection with the United States and normalize relations, were destroyed. At that point, they were actually even trying to work alongside the United States intelligence to sort of show some good faith. Obviously, none of that worked, and at every step, in every turning point in the past 20 years, the United States has done its best to destabilize governments, destabilize the region, extract resources, and sort of leave a destroyed country in every sense behind. Now, if you look at the past 20 years, there's the 9/11 attacks. Immediately afterwards, we have the escalation in Afghanistan, the war in Iraq. It's a 20-year range, and you see they're surrounding countries like Iran at the same time with military forces by the United States, right? Ramping up sanctions and escalating against countries like Iran at the same time. Now, the connection to all of this is that, for example, Iran was home to most of Afghan refugees and Iraqi refugees that basically had to leave their homes after the attacks by the United States, right? After the war. Now, after a decade, actually, I don't remember the exact date of the migration crisis in Greece, but it was as a direct result of the sanctions of the United States on Iran, because the people who were taking refuge could not make the same money that they were making before to feed their families anymore. So they had to leave the place of refuge that they had took, not even their original home again, and that wave created the crisis that you all know about. It puts in perspective a lot of the things that Halima was pointing out to. For example, the fee waiver. Yeah, we might not think that $540 or whatever that number was is too much, but I was just pointing out to Don that my father in Iran, as a high government employee, makes probably 1/5 or 1/6 of that. The average worker in Iran, I'm setting Iran as an example, the currencies are pretty much similar there, work, labor, is 1/10 of that. So people can't even pay to apply to take refugees in another country. Anyways, I would like to pass it on to Don again to talk about what we're doing, the steps we're taking to take, this apart and basically oppose it from our perspective and organizing.
Yeah, thanks, Apet. So our focus at the moment on the No War campaign under the DSA, our Anti-War International Committee, is to try and to try and take down the legal and policy infrastructure of the war on terror that has been in place for 20 years now. On September 18th, we're coming up on the 20th anniversary of the 2001 authorization for the use of military force. That was the legal basis for the war in Afghanistan and remains the legal basis for all of the drone strikes, all of our wider military action overseas for the war on terror. When that was passed, there was only one vote against it, Barbara Lee from San Francisco, who said at the time that this was a blank check for the president to attack anywhere, any person for any reason for as long as they want. And that critique back in 2001 has turned out to be exactly correct. The war on terror has distorted American life, I would say, and life across the globe in incalculable ways. And even though we have withdrawn from Afghanistan now, the legal infrastructure to continue to strike Afghanistan and to continue to strike Pakistan, continue the drone program, remains in place. And that is the AUMF 2001. So I would ask people to join the international committee and join us on the campaign to repeal this horrendous piece of legislation that should never have been put in place, but there's even less justification for it now that the United States has withdrawn from Afghanistan. We don't want a situation again where the president can, without even having to go to Congress, an institution that I think we can probably agree is already far too awash with defense contractor money, doesn't even have to go there to strike another nation and to go to war in another nation. So that would be my pitch, Jack.
I would like to.
I think it's absolutely. Sorry, Sapir. Do you have just a quick comment?
Absolutely. I would like to add that by connecting our campaign to the efforts like Halima's and their organization, we want to also keep alive the analysis that we have and what we're giving. For example, like about joint strikes, Halima was just saying, and I just saw someone from a think tank in Britain saying, say what you want about drone strikes, but they got us out of the stalemate of Afghanistan, which is just a horrific comment to make by a British-Iranian person. Anyways, I'm sorry, passing it on to you.
Yeah, you know, Sapir, I think, I would agree, and I would also agree. I think the campaign to kind of overturn the AUMF is absolutely critical, and I think we also have to kind of get at the root of the war on terror and the kind of the absurdity of it, and kind of the situation in the Middle East in general is that you mentioned the war in Iraq. Well, the CIA actually propped up the Ba'ath Party in Saddam Hussein in the first place as an effort to destroy the Communist Party in Iraq. And as Don was hitting at, the Mujahideen arose through support with the United States, and Al-Qaeda is deeply connected to the Saudi ruling class as well, which there's strong evidence was heavily involved in 9/11. Osama bin Laden was a member of the Saudi ruling class. And we, the United States and defense contractors, sell hundreds of billions of dollars to the Saudi ruling family, which is essentially a fascist political entity every year. So I just want to make sure we get to these callers really briefly. We have a caller. You're live on Revolutions Per Minute on WBAI. Please make a really brief comment or question. What's your name and what's your comment or question?
Hi. I'm on?
You're on.
I got it. Okay. William from Brooklyn. The thing that kind of scares me is that various leftist organizations, including DSA, which have grown dramatically with paper members to 100,000, the number of people who are active is incredibly small And I'm 70 years old, and I've been at this for a while. I'm just not feeling really good, even though lots of young people think socialism is not a dirty word. But I'm checking out.
I don't want to cut you off because we are getting to the show. So I just want to briefly respond to that because I think I get the gist of your question. I think it's something that's really, really crucial to consider is that a lot of things that are going on in the movement are not things that are also out in the open. There's a lot happening in the labor movement right now, both in terms of strikes, in terms of taking over leadership, about taking over locals. And the big things are happening and they're about to happen. And think about this, that when we have education strikes and we've had them across basically general strikes, it's not just the workers in the school, it's all the students. And so that's something to really think about, and that there's big things about to happen. There's also a lot happening in the movement internationally. The socialist movement and the communist party states are very, very powerful. And so a lot is happening across the globe for the workers' movement. And so I think we have to be much, much more optimistic. We have socialist electeds that are connected to a political organization that's connected to the labor movement that is happening at a higher level than we've seen in this country really ever. So I think we got to really take that in consideration. So let's get to the next caller. You are live on WBAI and Revolutions Per Minute. What's your name and what's your comment and or question?
Good evening. My name is Rose. I live in Flemington, New Jersey. And I want to make a comment about the Mujahideen, which Brezhnev, who was Jimmy Carter's choice, he certainly didn't start up with that group. It was probably about leftover from Nixon. But they managed to go in and kick the Russians out of Afghanistan, and then they became the Taliban. They became the tribes. And our CIA came up with about $7 million just to buy the rights to get something called the Turkestan to Pakistan oil pipeline from something called Onkal, something that Dick Cheney was involved in. But if you really want to fry your hair, you need to turn back to Sunday night this week. I happened to roll into something called Zuma Radio out of Toronto and listen to an old tape on someone who'd written a book about the subject who discussed the fact that...
I'm sorry, I don't want to cut you off. We're just getting to the end of the show. Thing that the Mujahid is was directly tied to the CIA, to American imperialism, and is part of the broader reactionary forces in the region that have created this situation, the project of American empire to destroy and undermine the kind of organic local and national left throughout the Middle East that had powerful organizations and was waged war against. And we are at 9:58, so it is time to end the show. I just want to thank all of our guests tonight for really great comments, for all the work that they're doing. We'll link to some of that in the show notes. We'll have a podcast coming out. This is Jack Devine with Revolutions Per Minute, and we'll be back next week. We'll see you in the workplace organizing, in your apartment organizing, and out in the streets as we prepare to fight for the struggle to come. See you next week.